Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian Flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Then press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day, helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
All right. Hello, everybody. Hopefully you guys are tuned in. You can definitely call in and listen to the show. This is a special edition Lucid Libertarian. Not too long ago, I started playing a series called The Fall of the Cabal, and you can find that on BitChute. Look up Fall Cabal, S as in Frank, A-L-L, C-A-B-A-L, all one word, on BitChute and follow them. Originally, the first show that I did, I got through most of the initial Follow the Cabal series, which has a total of 10 parts to it. And then on the second show that I continued on with that series, we finished that up and then started the next phase of it, which is the sequel to the Follow the Cabal series. The sequel to The Fall of the Cabal has a total of 22 parts currently. They just added another one recently. So tonight is going to be starting out with part 3 of the sequel to The Fall of the Cabal. With the my second show, we played part 1 and part 2. Of sequel of The Fall of the Cabal. So here we go on show 3, and we're going to start playing part 3 of Fall of the Cabal. So again, if you look up Fall Cabal on BitChute, which in the description of this show on Blog Talk, I have a link to it, and you can go ahead and subscribe to it. I encourage you to watch these videos because obviously when we're doing it over the air, you're losing all the visuals that they put into it. You know, they, you know,
put graphic images of the articles that they reference, photos of people, things like that that go along with what they're talking about. So I encourage you to watch the videos. As a matter of fact, you can sync them up with me if you like, because before I play each part of these series, I will give a moment so that if you are, you know, opening up on a new tab, the Fall of the Cabal or Fall Cabal page on BitChute, and if you go to, if you scroll and you find the sequel to the Fall of the Cabal series, then you can kind of follow along as I play them over the air if you want to do it that way, so you can watch it in addition to listening to it. And kind of try to sync it up a little bit like that, so that way you don't miss those visuals. And one of the reasons why I started to play this was because I just found it to be a very, very interesting series of videos covering everything having to do with the Cabal, from, you know, the research into the history of this global plan for a new world order that has always been the case, and the history behind it all. And then continuing on to what we're facing today, particularly with all of the COVID lockdowns and the vaccination, if you want to call it that, the clot shot as I've come to know it, and the corruption they even get into like five parts of the sequel to Follow the Cabal is just dedicated to Bill Gates alone. So they really get into Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation in addition to a whole lot of other things. So very, very interesting series. And they are followers of Q, just to put that out there. But don't dismiss it just because of that. And even if, let's say, 90% of it is true and 10% of it is false, or even 80% is true and 20% of what they present is false, then don't dismiss the original 90% or 80% that's true. You know, it really is a thought-provoking series to get people thinking about what's going on, and they really did a very good job, actually, of the research that, you know, back up what they're saying. So, you know, listen to it with an open mind, watch the videos, and just take whatever truth from it you can. And if you want to look things up, great. Make notes while you're listening and watching on things to research for yourself, and try to determine for yourself what you believe and what you don't. So with that, and I might even continue this on tomorrow night, because I have a feeling we'll probably get through four, maybe five parts. And just so you know, if you want to call in, if I have callers here at the end of this, then we can definitely chat afterwards. So I have a two-hour plan currently right now with Blog Talk. So 2 hours is going to be the live broadcast. Then they include an additional hour for the show recording. So at 9 p.m. Pacific time, that's when, you know, it can be off-air conversation if there's anybody holding. But if you want to be included in that, call in to the show, and you don't have to raise your hand, but just call in and listen in. Just stay muted. If you call in before 8 p.m. Pacific, so you have to, that's the way it works. You got to call in and be listening actively before the live. All right, so my phone decided to drop on me, and hopefully I wasn't muted during everything that I just said. I guess we'll find out. So anyways, call in before 8 p.m. Pacific time during the live broadcast of the show. That way you can continue listening to the final hour that's part of the recording. And after that, we can have some discussion. So if there's some people hanging out and want to talk after 9 p.m. Pacific. Once I'm wrapped up playing all the parts of this series that I can, feel free to do so. Again, the guest call-in number is 563-999-3698. And you can just hang out and listen in if you want. And again, I'll try to mention that, you know, a couple of times while I'm doing this. So with that said, we are going to, I'm going to go ahead and cue up the where we left off from show number two, the sequel to The Fall of the Cabal. And we're picking it up at part three of the sequel to The Fall of the Cabal. And again, find them on BitChute, look up Fall Cabal on BitChute, subscribe to them, and then you can watch the videos as well. So we are going to kick this off. This part three is about 28 minutes long, and we're going to see how many of these parts we can get through between now and 9 p.m., and then hopefully there's some people hanging out on the line to discuss some of this afterwards. So here we go. A sequel to Follow the Cabal in 3, 2, 1, start.
Next, or rather simultaneously, it was time for the Cabal to take revenge on Russia once again. Financed by their partner in crime, the Rothschilds, they started the Russian Revolution. Their pawn and frontman, Lenin. His real name, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. Every historian will agree on the fact that Lenin was heavily influenced by Karl Marx, the founder of communism. But Marx wasn't Russian. He was German. Lenin was Russian, but as he spent many years in exile in Finland, Switzerland, England, and Germany, he had become almost a stranger to Russia at the time the first part of the Russian Revolution broke out in February 1917. He was completely westernized. Marx had inspired him massively with his 1848 pamphlet, The Communist Manifesto. Lenin wasn't just inspired by Marxist communism, but also by his Jesuit background. Marx was trained in Germany at a Jesuit school, and after that, he was tutored by Jesuits in the British Museum on the tenets of communism, as confirmed by ex-Jesuit priest Alberto Rivera. Another source of Marx being a Jesuit coadjutor, an assistant bishop, is Otto von Bismarck, who wrote in the North German Gazette that Marx was under control of the Jesuit priest Peter Beck, then superior general of the Society of Jesus. And there was more Jesuit influence on Lenin. His right-hand man, Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was the head of the Soviet secret police, was a great admirer of the Jesuits. Furthermore, Lenin formally readmitted the Jesuits into Russia in 1922, which is rather strange, as religion was prohibited at that time within communism. But then again, was it strange? The origin of communism lies in the Jesuit ideology, as confirmed by many historians. The Jesuits in the 17th and 18th centuries perfected the first system of communist governance in their reductions in Paraguay. In the New Advent Catholic Encyclopedia, it reads on the conditions of property, the economic basis was a sort of communism. The land and all that stood upon it was the property of the community. The land was apportioned among the caciques, who allotted it to the families under them. Agricultural instruments and cattle were loaned from the common supply. No one was permitted to sell his plot of land or his house. Very communist indeed. We will see later on in this documentary that even the term social justice was invented by the Jesuits. The first man to name it and write about it was the Jesuit Luigi Taparelli d'Azeglio. Lenin was a Jesuit puppet who was pushed forward by the cabal to destabilize and destroy the country. He hated Russia and the Russians. Some of his most famous quotes are, "I spit on Russia." While the state exists, there can be no freedom. When there is freedom, there will be no state. And may 90% of the Russians die and let the other 10% live under communism. The Russian Revolution was a Jesuit attack on the country. Their motive? Revenge. Their pawn? Lenin. Their tool? The Bolshevists. They were the equivalent of the Jacobins during the French Revolution. Millions of people died in Russia between 1917 and 1923, the year in which the Russian Revolution ended with the Bolshevist founding of the Soviet Union. Now, before we move on to World War II, where we will share with you a discovery that, quite frankly, knocked us off our feet, so keep watching, we will first take a look at a chain of events in the US. Maybe you remember from part 2 of the previous series that in 1913, the US Federal Reserve Bank was founded, the mother of all banks, owned by several cabal families, among which the Rothschilds. Remember what happened to the three wealthiest and most influential opponents of the Fed? They conveniently died when the Titanic sank. Less than a year later, the Fed was a done deal. In the US, at that time, about 21,000 banks did not yet fall under the jurisdiction of the Fed. That was, and still is, an absolute lethal thing to do. One might as well commit suicide, as history has proven over and over again, worldwide. In 1914, World War I started, 1 year after the establishment of the Federal Reserve. Between 1914 and 1919, the Fed doubled the money supply, causing a nationwide increase in lending. In 1920, it shrank the money supply and 5,500 competitor banks went bankrupt. They were bought by the Fed for next to nothing. Between 1921 and 1929, the Fed increased the money supply again. Loans were everywhere. But on October 23, 1929, 2.6 million shares were sold in a frenzy. By whom? Not that hard to guess. The next day, on October 24 at 9 a.m., Wall Street was closed and the moneymakers who had gathered outside slowly started to realize in a state of shock what had happened. Loans were called in. Investors were forced to sell their shares. This event became known in history as the Wall Street Crash. The Wall Street Crash brought the rest of the world on its knees too. 16,000 competitive non-Fed banks went bankrupt. They too were bought for next to nothing. It was called the greatest robbery in history. But it wasn't enough. The Fed reduced the money supply even further by 30%, causing starvation throughout the US. The Rothschilds had done what they had successfully been doing since the French Revolution, manipulating the stock market at the expense of the people to further increase their wealth and power. Congressman McFadden was so horrified he began impeachment proceedings against the bankers who owned the Federal Reserve. Like I said, he might as well have committed suicide straight away. He was poisoned at a banquet, and the impeachment was abandoned. One simply does not get in the way of the Khazarian cabal. 4 years after the Wall Street crash in 1933, on the pretext of getting out of the Depression, the banks persuaded the government to carry out a national gold seizure on penalty of imprisonment for 10 years. That's right. Under pressure of the Fed, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 6102 to make the impoverished American people give up their gold. They had nothing left. With the gold standard gone, the cabal had no more limitations on how they could manipulate the money supply. This meant absolute dominance. On top of everything else, income tax was created in 1913 to cover the huge amounts of money the government was paying the Federal Reserve. Like we said in part two of the previous series, income tax is illegal. We were just never told. One of the dire consequences of the Wall Street crash was that the Fed called in all international loans. The country that was the worst affected was Germany. After World War I, the country had to pay reparations to the victims for which it desperately needed the loans, as well as for rebuilding the country and the economy. When the Fed called in their loans, the German economy collapsed. The country dived into a deep depression. That same winter, about 2 million people were unemployed. Less than 3 years later, that number had tripled, meaning a staggering unemployment rate of 40%. The government's expenses to support these people went through the roof. The Chancellor cancelled unemployment support in a desperate move, which made things even worse. More chancellors came and went. Nobody knew what to do with this mess. People were losing faith in democracy. Music to the ears of the cabal, and sought help from extreme left, the communists, or extreme right, the Nazis. In January 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. Although he had a majority of seats in Parliament, he did not have the absolute power he desired. Conveniently, only 4 weeks later, the Reichstag, home of the German Parliament in Berlin, was set on fire, allegedly by communists. Hitler used the event to persuade President Hindenburg to pass an emergency act restricting personal liberty. The act abolished freedom of speech, assembly, privacy, and the press. It abolished the right to own property and the right to trial before imprisonment. It legalized phone tapping and interception of correspondence. The decree was used as the legal basis for the imprisonment of anyone considered to be opponents of the Nazis. People could be imprisoned for any or no reason. That night, around 4,000 people were arrested, imprisoned, and tortured by the SA. Hitler was now able to imprison communist leaders, so his main opponent during the elections, the Communist Party, fell apart. Hitler's SA intimidated the rest of the opposition, after which he pushed through the Enabling Act that enabled him to make laws without the Parliament's consent for the next 4 years. This gave Hitler absolute power. He then banned all political parties. Only the Nazi Party was allowed to exist. The final obstruction to absolute dictatorship was dealt with on June 30, 1934, called the Night of the Long Knife, when 400 SA members who were making demands were slaughtered by Hitler's SS. 1.5 months later, Hitler was in absolute control of Germany. He had become the Führer, meaning he was president, chancellor, and head of the army. Members of the armed forces had to swear a personal oath of allegiance, not to Germany, but to Hitler, which is so Jesuit. Remember the oath of absolute subservience and obedience to the Supreme General? Who was Hitler, really? Hitler came from an interesting family. His mother was Clara Pölzl. His father was Alois Hitler. Alois's mother is where things get really interesting. Her name was Maria Anna Schigelgruber. She was a simple peasant girl from a village called Stones near Dollesheim. At the age of 42, still being single, she gave birth to Alois. At the time she conceived, September 1846, Maria lived in Vienna, where she worked as a servant for none other than Anselm Salomon von Rothschild. As soon as the family discovered her pregnancy, she was sent back home, where Alois was born. Maria refused to tell who the father was. It must have been someone with power, for she kept it a secret for the rest of her life, and the father did not feel the need to marry her. When Alois was 5 years of age, Maria married Johann Georg Hitler. Even though many researchers believe he must have been Alois's biological father, he never acknowledged the boy as his own. It wasn't until Alois was 40 years old when he suddenly changed his surname from Schigelgruber to Hitler. Why wait so long if he was truly Hitler's son? That doesn't make sense at all. Alois married Clara Pölzl. It was his third marriage. They had 6 children, 4 of which died at a very young age. The only 2 surviving children were Adolf and his sister Paula. Nobody knows for sure who the biological father of Alois Hitler was. Several names have come forward. Leopold Frankenberger, Johann Nepomuk Hitler, Johann Georg Hitler's brother. But we found no real evidence for any of the above. They all seem to have been used as a decoy to take our attention away from Anselm Salomon von Rothschild. So, why do we believe it was Rothschild who impregnated Maria? Because of several indicators. First of all, 9 months before Alois's birth takes us to September 1836. According to the Rothschild archives in London, Maria worked as a maid for Anselm Salomon von Rothschild. Now there are 2 possible suspects of the rape of Maria. One, Anselm, who was 33 years old at the time. 2, his father, Salomon Meyer von Rothschild, who was 72 at that time. Now the Rothschild archives contain handwritten correspondence between the son, Anselm, and the London Rothschild Bank, which proves he was in Vienna at the time of the conceived pregnancy. His father, on the other hand, was in Paris. That narrows it down, don't you think? Secondly, in 1876, when Alois was 40 years old, he suddenly inherited a large sum of money. From whom? There wasn't any money in the family. Anselm Salomon von Rothschild died 1.5 years prior, the time needed to pass an estate through the probate court. It was the same time Alois suddenly changed his name to Hitler, remember? Was that just a coincidence, or was it a demand by the Rothschilds in order to receive the inheritance, so that it would not be traced back to the Rothschild bloodline? Now please bear in mind that officially, the Rothschilds were Jewish. They were the Babylonian Khazars who converted to the Jewish faith under pressure of the Russian king. Call them fake Jews if you like, but to the outside world, Adolf Hitler's father was half Jewish. If this ever came to light, it would be one hell of a scandal. And so, all traces of the Führer Adolf Hitler leading to the Rothschilds had to be erased. In 1921, the Munich Post intercepted a pamphlet that circulated among the early members of Hitler's Nazi Party, the NSDAP. The pamphlet's title was Adolf Hitler, Traitor. It dealt with the alleged Jewish blood in Hitler's veins. It accused Hitler of fronting for Jewish finances and for acting like a Jew himself. The Munich Post decided to publish the pamphlet. On the very day that Hitler became Chancellor, the Munich Post was ransacked and its editors and writers were sent off to concentration camps where they were never heard from again. The Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss investigated Hitler's family origins on two occasions. The first investigation, published in 1932, determined that Hitler's father was illegitimate, born to a 42-year-old unmarried woman and an unknown father. The second investigation determined that Hitler's mother was employed as a domestic servant in the residence of Baron Rothschild of Vienna. Shortly after, Hitler ordered the assassination of Dollfuss in 1934. Adolf Hitler once told his nephew, William Patrick Hitler, "These people must not know who I am. You must not know where I come from and which family I'm from." In an effort to erase any evidence that would lead Hitler back to the Rothschilds, not only were people murdered, but the entire village of Dollersheim, where Hitler's grandmother had come from, was completely destroyed on Hitler's orders. Adolf Hitler, the Führer, did not come out of nowhere. We believe he was a Rothschild, maybe an illegitimate one, but still. We saw in the previous series, in part 5, how the illegitimate James Alafantis Rothschild was pushed forward by the family to play a very important part in the US elite and their Pizzagate. Well, Adolf Hitler too was pushed forward the same way to influence the outcome of yet another Cabal War. Hitler was a great admirer of the founder of the Jesuits, Ignatius of Loyola. He said, "I learned much from the order of the Jesuits. Until now, there has never been anything more grandiose on the earth than the hierarchical organization of the Catholic Church. I transferred much of this organization into my own party." Hitler called Heinrich Himmler, the inventor and organizer of the Holocaust, the Reichsführer of the SS, and compared him to Ignatius of Loyola. The SS organization has been constituted by Himmler according to the principles of the Jesuit order. Their regulations and the spiritual exercises prescribed by Ignatius of Loyola were the model Himmler tried to copy exactly. Himmler's title as Supreme Chief of the SS was to be the equivalent to the Jesuit General, and the whole structure and direction was a close imitation of the Catholic Church's hierarchical order. Absolute obedience was the supreme rule. Every order had to be executed without comment. Hitler presented himself as the solution to all problems. He offered jobs in the war and weapon industry. He got rid of everyone he blamed for Germany's problems. The Jews, the gypsies, the communists, the disabled, the homosexuals, and he confiscated all of their money. Hitler was supported by a highly efficient propaganda machine led by SSer Joseph Goebbels, who brainwashed the German people into believing that Hitler was some sort of a messiah and that the Jews were the cause of all evil. Well, we all know what happened. 85 million people died in World War II. But the cabal wasn't done just yet. As you might know, in the aftermath of World War II, hundreds of thousands of Jews emigrated to the promised land of Israel. But did you know that this migration had already been planned by the Cabal in 1917? 22 years before World War II even started, Palestine was given away, literally, by Arthur James Balfour, Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, on behalf of the British government. As if nothing more but a chess piece, a country with inhabitants was given away to, guess who? Lord Lionel Walter Rothschild. But wait a minute. 1917? The First World War hadn't even ended yet. So how on earth could they be talking about a home for the Jews? The Jewish genocide hadn't even started yet. We're talking about the Balfour Declaration, signed by Balfour himself on the 2nd of November, 1917. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Arthur James Balfour. Neither the Jews nor the Palestinians knew about this. It was yet another brilliant move of nothing but chess pieces by the Cabal. What was presented as a benign action in favor of the Jews was, once again, a divide and conquer strategy. It could only end in yet another war, this time between Jews and Palestinians. The Jewish people were willingly and knowingly murdered 22 years after the Balfour Declaration was signed. Why? Because the Rothschilds and the other Cabal families had but one focus, Jerusalem. It's not by chance that so many family members have Solomon in their name. The Temple of Solomon, Temple Mount, and therefore the Land of Israel was their main priority. We will soon tell you why and expose their deepest and darkest secret. For now, millions of Jewish people were sacrificed in order to get there. There were many more wars to follow, like the Vietnam War, the Cold War. All were instigated and financed on both sides by the Cabal. That's how people across the world were kept in fear, paralyzed and poor, divided and subservient. Once you understand and see their strategy, you cannot unsee it. But the worst was yet to come, for times were changing and the Cabal adapted their strategy as time went along. Key words in their everlasting plan to conquer the world: hatred, revenge, disdain. These three words were perfectly combined in one document, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. the Protocols of Zion, dismissed as a hoax, but we can assure you, after months of in-depth research, that they are not. They were slightly altered, yes, but they are not a hoax. In 24 Protocols, the Elders of Zion describe their vision of the world, its population, and their ultimate goal, absolute world dominance and a one-world government. A new world order in which their king, the King of Kings, will be crowned on the throne of Zion to rule the world forevermore. Some people believe the protocols were copied from a 19th century book, The Dialogue in Hell Between Machiavelli and Montesquieu by Maurice Joly, in which Napoleon was ordered to Jew and France was ordered to the world. Others believe the Protocols of Zion were copied from Machiavelli, Montesquieu and Rousseau, written by Jacob Venedey. Then there was the theory of our friend Baruel. Remember him? He believed that the original culprits were not the Jews, nor Napoleon, but the Masons. Baruel wrote a series of four books about the French Revolution in which he presented evidence of the involvement of secret societies. So that's yet another theory. And then there was a court case in which the judge ruled the Protocols of Zion a forgery. Like we said, we studied the Protocols of Zion for months. We compared them with the original French version of Dialogue in Hell Between Machiavelli and Montesquieu by Joly. And yes, we did indeed find a lot of similarities. Some parts were even identical. Does that mean the protocols were copied? Stolen, if you like, from Joly's work? No, not necessarily. It only means they are connected. It only means the protocols were not new when they were published in Russia in 1905. They were not the minutes of a recent meeting between Zionists, as is claimed. But apart from that, one cannot draw any other conclusion. It would be a literary blunder to simply state that the Protocols of Zion were based on the work of Maurice Joly or Venedey or any other 19th century author. As a linguist with a degree in paleography, the study of ancient documents, I can assure you that most statements about the Protocols of Zion are incorrect, like the verdict of the court case, which was based on a highly unprofessional approach of the matter. The problem with the Protocols of Zion is that they are surrounded by emotions. The people who study them are confronted with their own belief system. Meaning, if you blame the Jews of the wrongs in the world, you will tend to believe the protocols are genuine. You will use the protocols as proof of the evil of the Jewish people. However, if you are Jewish, or if you lost your Jewish friends in the war, you will tend to believe the protocols are a fraud made only in Russia in 1905 to make the Jewish people look really, really bad. We believe the Protocols of Zion to be very old. It seems to us that they were the source text from which the other books arose, not the other way around. Remember Adam Weishaupt, founder of the Order of the Illuminati? In 1776, he put together a document that gave a clear overview of the aims, convictions, and protocols of the Illuminati, or the Cabal, the do's and the don'ts. That was his assignment, as given to him by Rothschild. Did he put those protocols together from scratch? We think that's highly unlikely. What if the original protocols were given to him by Rothschild? Remember the Constantinople letter given to Adam Weishaupt by Rothschild? Make no mistake, the Rothschild family was incredibly powerful. They were direct descendants from the Khazarian nobility that had fled Russia in around 1000 AD. You bet they had many original documents and protocols in their possession. Could those protocols be the original source text for the 20th century Protocols of Zion as published in Russia? If that is the case, you can rest assured that Khazar was altered in Jew, Khazarian in Jewish, etc. The perfect text that would come in very handy as a trigger for anti-Semitism in the Russian Revolution and both world wars to turn the Jews into the ultimate scapegoats. The more we studied this subject, the more we came to realize how the Jews have been used by the Khazars throughout the ages to receive the blame of everything. Everything that went wrong, everything the high-ranked Khazars did to suppress the people, everything was blamed on the Jews. After all, for the outside world, the Khazars were Jews, remember? Ashkenazi, Nazi. Do you still believe that's a coincidence? So, what exactly is in those protocols? Precisely what we see in our modern-day world. The protocols are a description of all the possible ways the Cabal used to control, manipulate, brainwash and dominate the Goyim, the ordinary people, the non-Khazars. Here they come, and you better hold on to your seat. Mind you, we narrowed it down for you, as there are not only 24 protocols, but also 293 paragraphs. We filtered them all down to the most essential ones, and in some cases, slightly altered the syntax of the sentences, so that the old use of words became more understandable. Each paragraph number will be shown on screen, in case you wish to do your own research, which we highly recommend. We advise you to listen carefully. This might be boring to some, but it's crucial information. If you skip this part, you will not understand part 15, for instance. And we can assure you, if you don't have the shivers from top to toe by the end of this part, you didn't fully get it. And we advise you to watch again. Here we go. First of all, their disdain, their contempt is shocking. The mob is savage and displays its savagery at every opportunity. The moment the mob seizes freedom in its hands, it turns to anarchy, which is the highest degree of savagery. We are interested in killing out the Goyim. Our power is in the chronic shortness of food and physical weakness of the worker, because that implies he is made the slave of our will. We shall move the mobs by want, envy, and hatred, and with their hands we shall wipe out all those who hinder us on our way. The Goyim are a flock of sheep, and we are their wolves. If we've been able to bring them to such a pitch of stupid blindness, is that not amazingly clear proof of the degree to which the mind of the Goyim is undeveloped in comparison with our mind? This is, mainly, which guarantees our success. The presidents are mere puppets on their strings. We replace the ruler of the republics by a caricature of a government, by a president taken from the mob, from the midst of our puppet creatures, our slaves. We shall arrange elections in favor of such presidents who have in their past some dark, undiscovered secret. This will make them trustworthy agents for the accomplishment of our plans out of fear of exposure and from the natural desire of everyone who has attained power, namely the privileges, advantages and honor connected with the office of president. We shall take the right to propose new laws or make changes in existing laws, as the president is only a puppet in our hands. Liberals and Masons are relentlessly used. The part played by the liberals, utopian dreamers, will be finally played out when our government is acknowledged. Till such time, they will continue to do us good service. Therefore, we shall continue to direct our minds to all sorts of vain conceptions of fantastic theories, new and progressive. Until we come into our kingdom, we shall create and multiply Masonic lodges in all the countries of the world, absorb into them all who are prominent in public activity. For these lodges are our principal intelligence office and means of influence. All these lodges we shall bring under one central administration, known to us alone and to all others absolutely unknown, which will be composed of our learned elders. The most secret political plots will be known to us and fall under our guiding hands on the very day of their conception. Among the members of these lodges will be almost all the agents of international and national police, since their service is irreplaceable to us as they have their own measures with the insubordinate. The class of people who willingly enter into secret societies are those who live by their reason, careerists, mostly light-minded people, with whom we shall have no difficulty in dealing and in using. But if there should arise in its midst a plot, then at the head of that plot will be no other than one of our most trusted servants. The goyim enter the lodges out of curiosity or in the hope to get a nibble at the public pie, and some of them in order to obtain a hearing before the public for their impracticable and groundless fantasies. They thirst for success and applause, of which we are remarkably generous. You cannot imagine to what extent the wisest of the goyim can be brought to a state of unconscious naivete in their arrogance, and how easy it is to take the heart out of them by the slightest ill success, though it be nothing more than the stoppage of the applause they had, and to reduce them to a slavish submission for the sake of winning a renewal of success. These tigers in appearance have the souls of sheep, and the wind blows freely through their heads. We execute Masons in ways that none but the Brotherhood can ever have a suspicion of, not even the victims themselves of our death sentence. They all die when required, as if from a normal kind of illness. Knowing this, even the Brotherhood dare not protest. By such methods, we have plucked out of the midst of Masonry the very root of protest against us. The press will be their golden tool to steer the mob. Through the press, we have gained the power to influence while remaining ourselves in the shade. Not a single announcement will reach the public without our control. All news items are received by a few agencies. These agencies will be entirely ours and will give publicity only to what we dictate to them. All our newspapers will be of all possible complexions: aristocratic, republican, revolutionary, even anarchical. Those fools who will think they are repeating the opinion of a newspaper of their own camp will be repeating our opinion, or any opinion that seems desirable for us. The people shall be distracted with empty words and broken promises. We shall raise the rate of wages, which, however, will not bring any advantage to the workers, for at the same time we shall produce a rise in prices of the basic necessities of life, claiming that it arises from the decline of agriculture and cattle breeding. There is another reason why they will close their eyes. For we shall keep promising them to give back all the liberties we've taken away as soon as we have quelled the enemies of peace and tamed all parties. We shall distract them with amusements, games, pastimes, fashions, people's palaces. Through the press we shall propose competitions in art, in sport, in all kinds. These interests will finally distract their minds. All layers of society will be infiltrated. It is from us that the all-engulfing terror proceeds. We have in our service persons of all opinions, of all doctrines, restorating monarchists, demagogues, socialists, communists, and utopian dreamers. We have harnessed them all to the task of drilling away the last remnants of authority. By these acts, all states are in torture and ready to sacrifice everything for peace and tranquility. But we will not give them peace until they openly acknowledge our international supergovernment and with submissiveness. We have got our hands into the administration of the law, into the conduct of elections, into the press, into liberty of the person, but principally into education and training as being the cornerstones of a free existence. The administrators whom we shall choose from among the public with strict regard to their capacity for obedience will not be persons trained in the arts of government and will therefore easily become pawns in our game in the hands of men of learning and genius who will be their advisors, specialists bred and reared from early childhood to rule the affairs of the whole world. We shall surround our government with a whole world of economists. Around us will be a constellation of bankers, industrialists, capitalists, and the main thing, millionaires, because everything will be settled by the question of figures. Who will ever suspect that all these people were stage managed by us, according to a political plan which no one has so much as guessed at in the course of many centuries? The ultimate threat. You may say that the Goyim will rise upon us, arms in hand, if they guess what is going on before the time comes. But in the West we have against this a maneuver of such appalling terror that the very stoutest hearts quail. The undergrounds, metropolitans, those subterranean corridors, which, before the time comes, will be driven under all the capitals, and from where the capitals will be blown into the air with all their organizations and archives. They will cause mayhem. We have stirred up every form of enterprise. We have armed all parties. We have set up authority as a target for every ambition. Of states, we have made gladiatorial arenas where a lot of confused issues contend. A little more, and disorders and bankruptcy will be universal. This hatred will be further magnified by the effects of economic crises, which will stop dealing on the exchanges and bring industry to a standstill. Universal economic crises whereby we shall throw upon the streets whole mobs of workers simultaneously in all the countries of Europe. These mobs will rush to shed the blood of those whom they have envied from their cradles in the simplicity of their ignorance and whose property they will then be able to loot. Remember the French Revolution? The secrets of its preparations are well known to us, for it was wholly the work of our hands. There will be a transition period. In order to put public opinion into our hands, we must bring it into a state of bewilderment by giving so many contradictory opinions that the Goyim will lose their heads in the labyrinth and come to see that the best thing is to have no opinion of any kind in political matters. In order for the people to become accustomed to obedience, it is necessary to give lessons of humility and therefore to reduce the production of articles of luxury. We shall re-establish small master production, which will mean laying a mine under the private capital of manufacturers. In the resulting chaos, people will fail to understand one another. It will discourage any kind of personal initiative which might hinder our affair in any degree. There is nothing more dangerous than personal initiative. If it has genius behind it, such initiative can do more harm to us than can be done by millions of people among whom we have sown discord. We must so direct the education of the Goyim communities that whenever they come upon a matter requiring initiative, they may drop their hands in despairing impotence. We shall so wear down the Goyim that they will offer us international power that will enable us without any violence gradually to absorb all the state forces of the world and to form a super government. In place of the rulers of today, we shall set up a super government administration. Its hands will reach out in all directions, and its organization will be of such colossal dimensions that it cannot fail to subdue all the nations of the world. The moment of the recognition of our despot will come when the peoples, utterly weary by the incompetence of their rulers, a matter which we shall arrange for, will cry out, "Away with them!" and give us one king over all the earth who will unite us and annihilate the causes of disorders, who will give us peace and quiet, which we cannot find under our rulers and representatives. Then will the mob exalt us and bear us up in their hands in a unanimous triumph of hopes and expectations, voting which we have made the instrument which will set us on the throne of the world, will then have served its purpose and will play its part for the last time. The new kingdom will be blood-curdling. We shall create an intensified centralization of government in order to grip in our hands all the forces of the community. We shall regulate all the actions of the political life of our subjects by new laws. These laws will withdraw one by one all liberties of the Goyim, and our kingdom will be distinguished by a despotism of such magnificent proportions that we can wipe out any Goyim who oppose us by deed or word. The word freedom brings out the communities of men to fight against every kind of force, every kind of authority, even against God and the laws of nature. For this reason, when we come into our kingdom, we shall have to erase this word, freedom, from the lexicon of life, as implying a principle of brute force which turns mobs into bloodthirsty beasts. Freedom is the right to do that which the law allows. All freedom will thus be in our hands. In our programs, one-third of our subjects will keep the rest under observation from a sense of duty on the principle of volunteer service to the state. It will then be no disgrace to be a spy and informer, but a merit. When we at last definitely come into our kingdom by the aid of coup d'etat prepared everywhere for one and the same day, we shall make it our task to see that plots against us shall no longer exist. With this purpose, we shall slay without mercy all who take arms to oppose our coming into our kingdom. Every kind of new institution of anything like a secret society will be punished with death. Those now in existence are known to us, serve us, and have served us. But we shall disband them and send them into exile to continents far removed from Europe. In this way, we shall proceed with those Goy Masons who know too much. Those we may spare will be kept in constant fear of exile from Europe as the center of our rule. One authority will be glorious because it will be all-powerful. Our authority will be the crown of order, and in that is included the whole happiness of man. We, the lawgivers, shall execute judgment and sentence. We shall slay and we shall spare. We rule by force of will, and the weapons in our hands are limitless ambitions, burning greediness, merciless vengeance, hatred and malice. Resolutions of our government will be final, without appeal. Judges decide as we dictate them. When the time of our overt rule comes, all our laws will be brief, plain, stable, without any kind of interpretations, so that anyone will be in a position to know them perfectly. The main feature is submission to orders, and this principle will be carried to a grandiose height. Criminals will be arrested at the first, more or less, well-grounded suspicion. It cannot be allowed that out of fear of a possible mistake, an opportunity should be given to escape to persons suspected of a crime, for in these matters we shall be literally merciless. We shall re-educate the universities in a new direction. Their officials and professors will be prepared by detailed secret programs of action and will be so placed as to be wholly dependent upon the government. We shall replace the study of ancient history with a study of the program of the future. We shall erase from the memory of men all facts of previous centuries which are undesirable to us, and leave only those which depict all the errors of the government of the Goyim. We shall abolish every kind of freedom of instruction. It is indispensable for us to undermine all faith, to tear out of the mind of the Goyim the very principle of God and Spirit, and to replace them with arithmetical calculations and material needs. When we come into our kingdom, it will be undesirable for us that there should exist any other religion than ours of the one God with whom our destiny is bound up by our position as the chosen. We must therefore sweep away all other forms of belief. Our preaching of the religion of Moses has brought all the peoples of the world into subjection to us. Our philosophers will discuss all the shortcomings of the various beliefs of the Goyim, but no one will ever bring under discussion our faith from its true point of view, since this will be fully learned by none save ours, who will never dare to betray its secrets. Freedom of the press, the right of association, freedom of conscience, the voting principle must disappear forever from the memory of man and undergo a radical alteration the day after the promulgation of the new constitution. What we want is that from the first moment of its promulgation, while the peoples of the world are still stunned by the accomplished fact of the revolution, still in a condition of terror and uncertainty, they should recognize once and for all that we are so strong, so superabundantly filled with power that in no case shall we take any account of them. And so far from paying any attention to their opinions or wishes, we are ready and able to crush with irresistible power all expression or manifestation thereof at every moment and in every place, that we have seized at once everything we wanted and shall in no case divide our power with them. Then in fear and trembling they will close their eyes to everything and be content to await what will be the end of it all. We've been leading the peoples from one disenchantment to another, so that in the end they will turn also from us in favor of that King Despo of the blood of Zion, whom we are preparing for the world. The new king, the chosen one. This chosen one of God is chosen from above to demolish the senseless forces moved by instinct and not reason, by brutishness and not humaneness. These forces now triumph in manifestations of robbery and every kind of violence under the mask of principles of freedom and rights. They have overthrown all forms of social order to erect on the ruins the throne of the King of the Jews. But their part will be played out the moment he enters into his kingdom. Then it will be necessary to sweep them away from his path. When the King of Israel sets upon his sacred head the crown offered to him by Europe, he will become patriarch of the world. This king will be the real Pope of the universe, the patriarch of the international church. The protocols of Zion portray the world as it is today. Well, almost. The Khazarian King of Kings is not on the throne in Jerusalem just yet. The world population has not begged the cabal to bring order out of chaos just yet. But are we far away from their end goal? Follow me to part 5.
All right, we just concluded part 4 of the series to the fall of the cabal. I am going to kick off part 5 here in just a moment. We have about 45 minutes left of the live broadcast. So if you're going to call in, do so within the next 45 minutes while we're on the live broadcast. The number is 563-999-3698. And that way you can continue to listen to the last hour that is not going to be a live broadcast, but part of the recording. So I will continue to play this through 9 p.m. Pacific time. And then after that, the recording ends. But if you're hanging out, if you've called in before the live broadcast ends at 8 p.m. Pacific time and you're hanging out on the line, then once we wrap up playing the parts as part of the recording, then we can chit-chat for a little while off-air. So definitely, again, if you want to call in, do so before 8 p.m. Pacific time, about 45 minutes, 563-999-3698, and then you can continue to listen to the final hour that I'm broadcasting this, and we can chat after that. So I am going to kick off part 5. It's about 28 minutes, 40 seconds long. So if you're out there and you're watching on BitChute, queue up part 5 on BitChute, sequel to Fall of the Cabal. And then that way you can hopefully sync it up and watch it while you're listening as well. Because, again, the visuals are also really intriguing as you watch the video. So here we go, part 5. We're kicking off here in 3, 2, 1, launch.
Let me take you on a field trip to Georgia, U.S. On a hill in Elbert County, there is a granite monument called the Georgia Guidestones. Built in 1980, the monument is veiled in mystery. It was commissioned by a man who used the pseudonym R.C. Christian. He paid a handsome price, but insisted on remaining anonymous. The monument consists of 4 massive standing stones, 1 slapstone at the top, carried by a pillar stone, plus 1 explanatory stone. 2 things are captivating. First of all, the monument is an astronomical clock and calendar, focused on the sun, the moon, the equinoxes, and the solstices. A hole was drilled in one of the stones, through which one can see the North Star. Secondly, the stones contain text, information about the future Earth and the era of reason. It is written in 8 modern languages. The shorter message is inscribed all around the top stone in 4 ancient languages: Babylonian, Classical Greek, Sanskrit, and Ancient Egyptian. This is the message. Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. Unite humanity with a living new language. Rule passion, faith, tradition, and all things with tempered reason. Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts. Let all nations rule internally, resolving external disputes in a world court. Avoid petty laws and useless officials. Balance personal rights with social duties. Prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. Be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. leave room for nature. In short, population control, the annihilation of a large part of the population, specific reproduction through eugenics, one language, one world court, social duties over personal rights, reason over passion, price, truth, whose truth, and nature over the human race, the cancer of the earth. And not to forget what they call the age of reason, not the age of love, or the age of compassion, or the age of abundance for all. Obviously, this monument cannot be accused of being a hoax. After all, it simply stands there. So, what are we looking at? Who on earth was the mysterious Mr. Christian who was willing to pay so much money for something so intricate and controversial? It seems to us that the Georgia Guidestones perfectly demonstrate the goal of the Cabal, the Protocols of Zion, and the way they've been trying to hide their true intentions by means of the eagerly gullible term sustainability. So, what do we see in our world today that is a reflection of these guidelines, these goals? Enter the United Nations. Believed by the majority of the people to be a wonderful institution, the UN was founded right after World War II in October 1945. Officially, the UN was set up to maintain worldwide peace and security and to develop relations and cooperation among nations. Their blue helmets are associated by many with the protection of the people. They are called the peacekeepers. Well, that's one side of the coin. The other side shows quite a different picture. A picture in which the UN's goal is a new world order, a one-world government as promoted by the learned elders of Zion. Is that a proven fact? Yes. In 2008, the UN actually set up their very own UN New World Order project, led by Nelson Mandela's grandson and ex-CIA Jaime Illien. According to highly influential people like the presidents Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. and Gorbachev, the New World Order must be founded on the principle of collective security. And that is precisely where the UN comes in. The UN Blue Helmets can lawfully intervene whenever the UN believes a country is a danger to collective security. They can lawfully send an army and attack that country, like they did in the Korean War in 1950, and again in the Persian Gulf in 1990. Or they can lawfully send military missions to a country like in Sierra Leone from 1999 till 2006. The UN Army comprises of 70,000 soldiers from various countries. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Well, let's put it this way. Assuming that the intent was good, the outcome was often bad, terrible as a matter of fact, even shockingly horrific. Now we understand that many people will have a very hard time realizing that organizations such as the UN and its WHO are not the benign entities they claim to be. We understand the level of cognitive dissonance, of denial that we may trigger. But it is imperative to realize that both the UN and the WHO are cabal machines to the core. They hide behind a facade of beauty, but make no mistake, behind their mask, these entities are monsters. So, in order to deal with the myth of the peacekeepers, here are some facts that everybody needs to know. The UN has been involved with sexual exploitation and abuse for decades. There have been countless reports of sexual abuse, rape, women and child trafficking. When UN peacekeepers were stationed in Cambodia in 1993, the number of prostitutes rose from 6,000 to more than 25,000 in that year alone. The widespread use of prostitutes involved violent sexual abuse of girls. The UN response was threefold. The head of mission declared it wasn't important enough to follow up on and that boys will be boys. Mission leadership advised peacekeepers not to wear uniforms when visiting prostitutes or park UN vehicles directly outside. And an additional 800,000 condoms were shipped to Cambodia to prevent the spread of HIV. Ah well, 1993, that's a long time ago. Okay, 2 years later, in 1995, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, evidence emerged that women and girls were being trafficked to work as sex slaves for UN personnel, and later that interveners were complicit in sex trafficking. However, it took 6 years before the UN came forward with its statement, and only because of rising public attention. Investigation into this matter reported an obvious reluctance by the UN to recognize the involvement of peacekeepers in trafficking. The result? Did the UN prosecute any of the abusers or traffickers? No, it did not. It rewrote the definition of trafficking, making it less severe a crime under international law, and failed to provide adequate victim protection. Shortly thereafter, independent consultants raised the alarm that UN and NGO staff were abusing and exploiting local women and girls in refugee camps in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. According to an OIL investigation in 2001, sexual exploitation and abuse was most common. Examples? The sexual relationship between a UN civilian staff member and a 17-year-old refugee in exchange for school fees. The violent rape of girls by NGO staff. The rape of boys by Blue Helmets in Sierra Leone. The exchange of sex for food provided by NGO staff. And the refusal of international staff to take responsibility for children fathered with local women. From opportunistic sexual abuse, transactional sex, and networked sexual exploitation to planned sadistic attacks. 2015, Central African Republic. Two girls aged 14 and 18 were gang raped by armed MINUSCA peacekeepers near their base. The 18-year-old had asked for some food. The 14-year-old had simply walked by. Same year, same country. Homeless and starving boys aged 8 to 15 were repeatedly raped by 26 UN peacekeepers. And UN peacekeepers randomly shot and killed a 16-year-old boy and his father and raped a 12-year-old girl. 2016, more than 108 additional cases were investigated, including the sexual abuse of 98 girls by international peacekeepers. The list of sexual exploitation and abuse is endless. in every single country, from Haiti to Somalia to Rwanda and Liberia, where 58,000 women and girls were raped in the first 9 years of UNMIL, more of 75% by UN personnel, from East Timor to Sarajevo, Bosnia, where Italian peacekeepers ran child prostitution rings from their barracks, the Blue Helmets left a trail of abuse and trauma. As one of the official reports so strikingly put it, many parts of the world where the UN was present were descending into chaos, if not hell, and arguably with the assistance of the UN. There were plenty of investigations, but hardly any of the perpetrators who admitted to their crimes were prosecuted. Let that sink in. Even recently, the UN was once again connected with child trafficking and child abuse, when Canadian UN mogul Peter Dalglish was caught in the act abusing two young boys in Nepal. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison. Up until his arrest in 2019, Dalglish had been presented as a saint, a protector of children. He was country representative for UN Habitat in Afghanistan. He truly was into children. He even set up Street Kids International to help homeless children. What a saint. What a great loss to our children. Oh, and the UN have more on their slate. Remember the war in former Yugoslavia from 1992 till 95? In July 95, the UN failed to protect the so-called safe area in the enclave of Srebrenica. Instead of protecting the Bosnian people who had fled there, the UN Dutch bat turned away. There was nothing they could do. They too had been betrayed at the highest level. ...8,372 Bosnian men and boys were separated from their families one night and were slaughtered by Serbian armed forces. More than 100,000 people were massacred in this useless war, mostly Bosnians. Between 30 and 50,000 Bosnian women, children and elderly were raped and deported. The official status of genocide wasn't acknowledged under international law until 2004. Back to the official mission of the UN, to turn this world into a better place. This is highlighted by the Club of Rome, a group of 100 powerful men and women set up in 1968 by, among others, David Rockefeller at his private estate near Rome. A private club presenting itself as a think tank, providing suggestions to the UN. Its goal? To discuss its concern about the future of planet Earth, to come up with solutions, and to urge governments worldwide to act upon those solutions. In 1972, the Limits to Growth was published, the Club of Rome's first paper on the problems of humanity, followed by the first global revolution in 1991, in which humanity was outed as the root problem of all the misery in the world. In need of a common enemy against whom we can unite, we have decided that pollution, global warming, water shortages, famine, etc. are perfect. These are threats we need to confront together. But we should not fall into the trap of mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy is humanity itself. This, my friends, was the foundation of everything that was about to unfold. Humanity as the cause of all problems. The UN was delighted by the Club of Rome. It had founded the World Commission on Environment and Development in 1983. And the parallels with the conclusions of the first Global Revolution research paper were obvious. From now on, sustainability was the cabal's magic word. And so, in 1992, the first United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, or Earth Summit, was held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where the first Agenda for Environment and Development, also known as Agenda 21, was developed and adopted. 21 was a reference to the 21st century, when all of the set goals would have to be met. 178 governments agreed with and signed the agreement. At the UN Sustainable Development Summit of 2015, Agenda 2030 was presented, an extended version of Agenda 21. 11 more goals were added to the original agenda, all aimed at the future of our planet and the human race, all aimed at sustainability. By now, 193 countries were participating. Do you know how many countries there are in the world? Only two more. 195. The only two that are called observer states are the Vatican and Palestine. Agenda 2030 contains 91 paragraphs. Paragraph 59 outlines 17 sustainable development goals. There are 169 targets and 232 indicators. This makes it a rather dry document to digest. But we read it, and we were impressed. Impressed by the level of cleverness and cunningness with which something so evil was put together so seemingly benign. Using complex phrases in which words like peace, equality, safety and security are repeated frequently, the reader is actually left with a good, positive feeling. We'll show you the 17 Sustainable Development Goals in the following slide. Feel free to pause the video and have a proper look. We will, however, continue swiftly as we wish to point out where things go wrong, not where things appear to be right. Let's face it, these goals are not feasible. The Club of Rome and the UN can use as many beautiful words as they can come up with, but how on earth are they going to accomplish these 17 goals? By asking you and me to pay more tax? Think about it. Number one, end poverty in all its forms everywhere. Really? How? The word sustainable is used 10 times. Why? To throw fairy dust into our eyes so that we don't see? So that we will willingly pay more tax and more tax and more? So that the world will be saved from us, the cancer of the earth? There is nothing sound about these 17 goals. There is no logic. Take goal number 7. Ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable and modern energy for all. How? Are they finally giving the oppressed free zero-point energy of Nikola Tesla to the people? Really? The real reason why these goals were put together is to come to the conclusion that they can never be achieved as long as all the participating countries in the world and all their governments have to communicate with each other. That too much time too much money is lost due to endless meetings. I'll bet you that the next step will be the announcement of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals can only be reached with a one-world government. The countries will have to give up their sovereignty in order to save the world. Mark my words. The essence of the entire Agenda 2030 is socialist communistic. It describes equal distribution of goods and money, which sounds great, but which in fact means that the rich countries are to share their wealth with the poor countries. These poor countries are generally run by highly corrupted usurpers, dictators, such as Kenyatta of Kenya and Obiang of Papua New Guinea, or Xi Jinping of China. Are they going to share their wealth, their blood money, with their people? That sounds like a wonderful idea to get rid of poverty once and for all. Everybody would be rich in a split second. Let's take all the money from these corrupted governments, add to it the immense wealth of the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, both the British and the Dutch royal families, and of course, the Vatican. Let's redistribute that wealth among the world population. My, what a marvelous idea to end poverty once and for all. Well, no. The people will share with the people. So in my case, the Dutch taxpayer will have to pay and share with the poor people of, in this example, New Guinea. Now don't get me wrong, I am for sharing, absolutely, but not according to the plans of the UN, where corrupt, malign governments remain unaffected. Read the paragraphs, the targets and indicators of Agenda 2030. Read them well, and you will see that the people will bleed, not the governments. Whenever governments talk about equality, you can rest assured that communism is involved, and they don't even hide it. Top globalists such as former NATO chief Javier Solana, a socialist, openly celebrate the plan as the next great leap forward. That's right, the old campaign slogan of the Chinese Communist Party. And isn't it odd that straight away, just about every country in the world decided to participate and work together? Every dictator of every corrupt government, who still had the blood on their hands of innocent civilian victims, signed Agenda 21 and later Agenda 2030. Countries that had been at war with each other for years, like for instance Ethiopia and Eritrea, now all of a sudden shook hands, smiled in front of the camera and decided to forget about their wars on drugs, weapons and people trafficking just to focus on the importance of a better world? On sustainability? Are you kidding me? What on earth were we looking at here? How much will the implementation of Agenda 2030 cost anyway? Well, according to the UN and confirmed by the World Bank in a 2015 statement, between $3 and $5 trillion per year. That is 12 zeros. $5 trillion per year. Where the hell is the UN going to get that money from? All those zeros are going to be collected from the taxpayers, from you and me. That's what the solution of the UN is all about. The moment a baby is born, that baby has a carbon footprint. And from the moment he or she was born, that baby will have to pay. Isn't that brilliant? The shame and blame that is put on you and me. My goodness me. Agenda 21, 2030, the Club of Rome, the UN. They all claim that we, the people, are to blame for the misery in the world, from poverty to inequality, from famine to the exhaustion of the planet's resources. Fine. Let's talk about the planet's resources, shall we? Ever heard of Henry Kissinger? Oh, you will. Let's continue to part 6.
All right, that was part 5 of the sequel to The Fall of the Cabal. And thank you for tuning in. Lots of information in here. And lots of stuff to make you go down like tons of rabbit holes for sure. So we're going to continue with the sequel to The Fall of the Cabal part 6 here in a moment. We have about 15 minutes left of the live broadcast time. So call in within the next 14 minutes or so while we're still live, 563-999-3698. Again, 563-999-3698. Call in before 8 p.m. Pacific time here in the next 14 minutes. That way you can continue to listen to the final hour that I will continue broadcasting this sequel to The Fall of the Cabal. And then if you do that and you're holding during that last hour, once I wrap up and the recording time is over, that ends at 9 p.m., where the show recording gets, you know, processed and stuff, we can still hang on the line and we can still chit-chat. So if you're out there and you want to call in, you want to chat for a little bit after the 3 hours of showtime is up, definitely call in while we're still live here. Again, 563-999-3698. And so again, if you have BitChute open with Sequel to Fall of the Cabal, Part 6, and you are trying to sync up, I'm going to kick that off here in just a couple seconds. It's about 33 minutes, 17 seconds long. And so we're going to fit that in, and hopefully we'll have time for at least one more after that. We should. Maybe even 2. I don't know. I guess we'll see. I'm not doing the math in my head very well right now. So anyway, 33 minutes or so for part 6. Here we go. I'm going to kick it off. 3, 2, 1, launch.
Henry Kissinger, world famous as U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor under Nixon and Ford, by some hailed as a hero, by others maligned as a war criminal. Kissinger wrote a top-secret report in 1973 called National Security Study Memorandum, or NSSM 200, also called the Kissinger Report. It talks about the planet's resources, all right. Henry Kissinger came up with a marvelous plan to consolidate the smooth flow of valuable resources from various countries across the world to the U.S. According to Kissinger, taking other countries' resources was easy as long as countries were stable. Unstable countries were difficult to access. So the question he posed was, how do we stabilize less developed countries? Because for some reason, the planet's most valuable resources, such as oil, natural gas, gold, and minerals, were all in less developed countries. In his infamous report, he wrote, "Wherever a lessening of population pressures through reduced birth rates can increase the prospects for such stability, population policy becomes relevant to resource supplies and to the economic interests of the United States." Fancy words to say that in order to create stability, one needs population policy. What does that mean? Legalizing abortion, giving families money if they use contraception, if they accept sterilization and or abortion. And if that isn't sufficient, population policy means forced birth control, forced sterilization, and forced abortions. Furthermore, Kissinger advised withholding aid, disaster aid, and food aid if a less developed country refused to implement the U.S. population control programs. That was the way to pillage a country of its resources, create stability by reducing the population, and most importantly, by getting rid of the anti-imperialist youth, the youngsters who tend to ask critical questions. They had to disappear. The result? A massacre worldwide, documented thoroughly in various excellent and courageous research papers that, for some reason, were ignored by the mainstream media and by the UN itself. We will give you two examples, two of many, China and Peru. We all know about China's one-child policy that started in 1979. In 2015, this policy was changed into a two-child policy if the first baby is a girl. How does that work in practice? With the financial help of the United Nations Population Fund, formerly known as the United Nations Fund for Population Activities, the UNFPA, China developed state-of-the-art tracking systems and computer surveillance programs to keep track of women's monthly cycles. And if a woman is pregnant, the program will know immediately whether the unborn baby is her first, or, if it's a second, whether her first child was indeed a girl. If the system shows the baby in her belly is not allowed by the government to be there, she will be arrested and have a forced abortion. That, my dear viewer, is China's policy as approved of and stimulated by the UN. As soon as I was taken out of the van, I saw hundreds of pregnant moms there, all of them just like pigs in the slaughterhouse. The room was full of moms who had just gone through a forced abortion. Some moms were crying, some moms were screaming, and one was rolling on the floor in unbearable pain. Then it was my turn. It was the end of the world for me. When the surgery was finished, the nurse showed me part of my baby's bloody foot with her tweezers. After the forced abortion, the fetus or baby is left with its mother, either in bed or in a bucket. This insane, sadistic cruelty is topped off with the absence of any kind of support system for the traumatized parents. As we want people to know what is happening in the world with the support of the UN, we will show some shocking pictures. If you don't want to watch, that's understandable and we fully respect that. Simply close your eyes for 16 seconds, starting from the moment the music changes. Now. Of course, the United Nations Population Fund denies being involved in forced abortions, but according to its own documents, it donated more than $100 million to China's population control program. It financed a $12 million computer complex, specifically to monitor the population program. It provided the technical expertise and personnel that trained thousands of Chinese population control officials. In China, abortions have been used as a weapon of mass destruction. Hundreds of millions of lives have been exterminated. The UN Population Fund was complicit in China's population control policies from the beginning. They did not only turn a blind eye to abuses, but helped facilitate and fund them. The UN Population Fund funded birth restrictions. It funded forced abortions. It funded China's coercive family planning bureaucracy. They also defended China's actions. Congressman Christopher Smith, co-chairman of the Congressional Executive Commission on China, 2017. One result of the one-child policy that we never hear the UN about is the surge in female infanticide that has now resulted in a disastrous sex ratio of 115 boys to every 100 girls. Female infanticide means that parents actually kill their baby girls. China has a cultural preference for boys, so the baby girls are killed. Do you know what that does to a parent? If you do, it will not surprise you that China has the highest female suicide rate in the world, and it is the only country listed where the number of suicides among women surpasses that of men. Any sympathy from the UN? No. On the contrary, the United Nations Population Fund presented China with a UN award for the most outstanding population control program. Oh, and let's not forget their official mission: to deliver a world where every pregnancy is wanted, every childbirth is safe, and every young person's potential is fulfilled. Under the one-child policy, the Communist Party, by its own estimation, prevented over 400 million births and carried out over 336 million abortions. More children were aborted under the one-child policy than the entire population of the United States. In April 2017, the Trump administration stopped funding the United Nations Population Fund. Peru. Between 1995 and 1997, over a quarter of a million Peruvian women were sterilized as part of a program to fulfill President Fujimori's family planning goals, financed by the U.S. Although this campaign was called the Voluntary Surgical Contraception Campaign, many of these procedures were forced. In fact, women whose underweight children were on government food programs were threatened with a withholding of this food if they refused to be sterilized, and others were kidnapped from their families and forcibly sterilized. In a little over 2 years, a quarter of a million women were deeply traumatized. Most of them were poor and indigenous. Not all women survived the surgery due to poor hygiene in the local hospitals. At least 100 women from my area went to the clinic that day. We were promised medicine. A lorry took us to the clinic. We all arrived innocent and happy. Then we heard screams and I just ran, but the doors were locked so I could not escape. I was 3 months pregnant. The health center staff knew this. They still went ahead. When I woke up, I was sterilized against my will. The examples go on and on and on. In every less developed country, the UN's concern was not with development, health, or women's empowerment, but with reversing the unchecked growth of the world population. From the very beginning, the concept of a population explosion was a false alarm specifically designed to allow rich nations to pillage the resources of the poorer nations. and Kissinger? He simply laid out the protocols of Zion for modern times. Who is Kissinger really? He was born in 1923 in southern Germany, right at the Cabal Center of Bavaria. His full name? Heinz Alfred Kissinger. He claims to be Jewish, but his credentials show all the signs of Khazarian roots. His family name wasn't Kissinger, it was Loeb. The name Kissinger was adopted in 1817 by his great-great-grandfather, Meyer Loeb, after the Bavarian town of Bad Kissingen. The name Meyer Loeb struck a chord. Hadn't we seen that name before? Meyer Amschel Rothschild's great-grandfather's name was Loeb Rothschild. Meyer Rothschild, Loeb Rothschild, Meyer Loeb Kissinger. We wouldn't be surprised if, one day, the truth will be presented about Henry Kissinger being a Rothschild. In order to understand the UN for what it really is, the ultimate cabal monster, one must know about the countless NGOs that are connected, directly or indirectly, to the UN. NGO means non-governmental organization. It means they don't have to pay tax, as they are non-profit organizations. It doesn't matter if they make astronomical piles of money. All NGOs are tax-exempt under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 501c. In this case, most of them are 501c3s and 501c4s. Not long ago, we believed NGOs do good things. Well, upon researching the NGOs set up by the UN and working for the UN, we were in for a rude awakening. We've already seen the United Nations Population Fund aiding and paying for the Chinese Communist government with its horrid population control policy. Then there's the Population Council, yet another non-profit organization aimed at eugenics and depopulation. Eugenics intends to improve the genetic quality of the human race. We all know where that led to in World War II. Isn't it remarkable that the Population Council actually presents itself as addressing critical health and development issues such as voluntary family planning and girl empowerment? Really? Let's have a closer look, shall we? The Population Council was founded in 1952 by John D. Rockefeller III. It addressed the problem of overpopulation, stating that modern civilization had reduced the operation of natural selection by saving more weak lives and enabling them to reproduce, resulting in a downward trend in genetic quality. That genetic quality had to be protected, and so the Population Council was set up to devote itself to reduce the fertility of the world population. Rockefeller became the organization's first president. He was succeeded by members of the American Eugenics Society. Early grants supported studies in embryonic development and paid for sterilization experiments on women with bad hereditary history. It was clear from the start that the Population Council had nothing to do with protecting women's health and safety. It had everything to do with the cabal's depopulation program. The intrauterine device they forced on millions of women in India, Pakistan, South Korea and Taiwan caused major side effects such as severe pains, protracted bleeding, pelvic inflammatory disease, and perforated uteruses. Nonetheless, with the help of the national governments of those countries that were paid millions of dollars in blood money, the birth control measures continued without any care or compensation for the women in question. In 1969, the Population Council published an article entitled Beyond Family Planning. The document offered legitimacy to, for instance, adding fertility control agents to water supplies in urban areas. Temporary sterilization of all young women via time capsule contraceptives. And compulsory sterilization of men with three or more children. Once again, the Population Council actually presents itself as addressing critical health and development issues, such as voluntary family planning. Voluntary? Really? These are the kind of population control NGOs we are dealing with. There are 37 NGOs right now that deal with the overpopulation program. 37 NGOs worldwide advocating negative population growth, repeating over and over again the words sustainability, devastating effects, overpopulation, environment. Call it group hypnosis. Call it brainwashing. You don't believe me? Here are just a few. Negative Population Growth, a non-profit membership organization that aims to educate the American public and political leaders about the devastating effects of overpopulation on the environment, natural resources, and the overall standard of living. They advocate for a significant reduction in current population numbers in the U.S. A significant reduction? How, for God's sake? The 10 Million Club Foundation. This Dutch foundation aims to bring about public awareness of the need to reduce the Netherlands' population significantly so as to create a truly sustainable society. Reduce the population of my country significantly? Excuse me? Rientro Dolce, an Italian association that concerns itself with overpopulation, environment, and energy. Its name comes from Marco Pannella's idea of a mild return to a world with 2 billion human beings. What? A mild return? What does that mean? Killing the other 5.5 billion softly with a smile? Hugging them to death? Oh, and then there's Planned Parenthood. Yet another NGO that has our best interests at heart. The International Planned Parenthood Federation was founded in Brooklyn, New York in 1917 by Margaret Sanger as a birth control clinic. In 1942, the name Planned Parenthood was chosen. Planned Parenthood grew into a huge enterprise with more than 600 abortion clinics in the U.S. alone. Every year, it is responsible for the abortion of approximately 350,000 babies. In several American states, abortion is allowed up to and including the moment of birth. Full-term abortion is the term coined for this event. The doctors at Planned Parenthood have no problems with this. On the contrary, on several occasions, medical staff were caught on hidden cameras selling body parts of aborted babies to third parties. Nurses admitted to knowing exactly how to turn the baby in its mother's womb so that the internal organs would not be harmed during the abortion in order to harvest them after the procedure. They admitted the aborted babies were alive when their bodies were cut open to retrieve the organs, commissioned by well-paying third parties.
A lot of people want to attack cards these days. They're looking for specific notes. Yes, it was the first time you said people wanted longer items.
Uh-huh.
And then, like I've always with many attack livers, people just want
liver is...
People want lower extremities right too. That's medical. I mean, that's... I don't know what
they're
doing,
but
they want muscle.
Yeah, a dime a dozen.
I'm the medical director for the national office for all
right.
of affiliates. You know, I'm going to throw a number out. I would say it's probably anywhere from $30 to $100, depending on the facility and what's involved.
The $30 to $100 price, that's per specimen that we're talking
per
about,
specimen.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
How much of a difference can that actually make if you know what kind of what's expected or what we need versus...
It makes a huge difference. I'd say a lot of people want liver.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, most providers have to take their own test items,
mm-hmm.
so they'll know where they're putting their foreign stuff. Kind of rate-limiting step of the procedure is calvarium. The head is basically the biggest part. Most of the other stuff can come out of the head.
Right.
Very rare to have patients that have enough diabetes. They've activated all the other
to bring the body cavity out,
exactly.
intact and all that.
Then you're just kind of cognizant of where you put your catheter. You try to do intentional go above and below the thorax so that, you know, we've been very good at getting hard, long liver.
Mm-hmm.
We know that, well, I'm not going to crush that part. I'm going to crush below, I'm going to crush above, and I'm going to see if I get out intact. And with the calvarium, in general, some people will actually try to change the presentation, but it's not vertex. It's vertex presentation. You never have enough dilation in the beginning unless you have real huge amount of dilation to deliver an intact calvarium. So if you do it starting from the breech presentation, there's dilation that happens as the case goes on, and often the last can evacuate an intact calvarium.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are certainly steps that can be taken.
So they can convert to breech, for example,
exactly.
at the start of the...
Exactly. They can convert to ultrasound guides, and they can just change the presentation. Federal abortion ban is a law, and laws are up to interpretation. So if I say on day one I do not intend to do this, what ultimately happens doesn't matter.
If we were to do an agreement with you guys, you know, what do we think you could get? I mean, what do you feel like you could get?
Volume-wise?
Yeah,
okay.
On specifically liver tissue, because that's
okay.
such an area of demand for us.
Right, so liver and what about intact specimens?
I mean, if you had intact cases, which we've done a lot, but we sometimes ship those back to our lab in its entirety.
What would keep your lab happy? Like, what would make your lab happy?
Another 50 livers a week.
You can handle that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you probably know potentially. I mean, I think that one of the issues with neural tissue is so fragile. It's insanely
right.
fragile.
Right.
I was going to say is that I know we get requests for it's the hardest thing in the world to ship.
You do it with the whole calvarium.
That's it. Yeah, that's the easiest way. And I mean, we've actually had good success with that in
yeah.
the past. So,
like, make sure the eyes are closed.
Yeah. Tell the lab it's coming.
Yeah.
Get all open the box.
Yeah,
oh, God. So, where so many of the academic labs cannot fly like that, they're just not capable.
Why is that? I don't understand it.
It's almost like they don't want to know where it comes from.
Yeah.
I can see that. Where they're like, we need limbs, but no hands and feet need to be attached. And you're like...
Or they just want the long bones and they don't want to see that
they want you to take it all off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, make it so that we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's like...
Bone the chicken for me and then
that's
we'll,
it.
You know,
so
and
like,
then I'll eat it. But
we know
before.
What it is.
Yeah.
I mean, but their lab...
So that whole stigma.
Oh, yeah.
And
their lab techs freak out and have meltdowns, and so it's just kind of like,
I think
you're either in the cause or you're not.
Yeah.
And if you're not
yeah.
in the cause, like, they don't need you around.
You need to get out.
They need champions.
Yeah.
And if
yeah.
you're not a champion, you should
right.
go.
Yeah.
Because that's just, you know, and I don't know, the clinic, you know, they're very guarded, as they should
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
yeah.
And who do they let in their house? They want champions in their house, right?
Hello, I'm Cecile Richards, President of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. I want to be really clear. The allegation that Planned Parenthood profits in any way from tissue donation is not true.
What would you expect for intact tissue? What sort of compensation? What sort of...
Well, why don't you start by telling me what you used to pay?
What you
really...
Oh, that's way too low. That's way too low. I want to keep you happy.
I've been at places that did 50 too. But see, we're not in it for the money. Now, this is for tissue that you actually take, not just the tissue that the person volunteers that you can't find anything.
Exactly.
And here's another thought is, you know, we can talk about specimen as per specimen per case or per procured tissue sample. Which would be, so if we're able to get a liver thymus pair, you know, maybe that is $75 per specimen, and so that's for, you know, liver thymus pair, and that's $150, versus if we can get liver thymus, brain hemisphere, and all that, then, you know, and then so that protects us so that we're not paying for what we can't use.
I want a Lamborghini. I don't want a Lamborghini.
Don't we all, right?
Planned Parenthood has been receiving millions from, for instance, the American government, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Buffett Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Turner Foundation, and many others. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave no less than $89.5 million to Planned Parenthood. Why? To kill unborn babies? Why the heck do they call this charity? The most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it. The most urgent problem today is how to limit and discourage the overfertility of the mentally and physically defective. A marriage license shall in itself give husband and wife only the right to a common household and not the right to parenthood. No woman shall have the legal right to bear a child, and no man shall have the right to become a father without a permit for parenthood. We don't want the word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population.
But for my view, I believe that there should be no more babies.
I admire Margaret Sanger enormously. Her courage, her tenacity, her vision.
President Trump ended the U.S. funding of Planned Parenthood in 2019. Oh, and just as we started editing this part 6, we received news that Henry Kissinger is one of 11 high-ranked officials who have just been removed from the Pentagon Defense Policy Board, effective immediately. Thank you, President Trump. We could talk about the UN forever. Its brilliant business construct, its evil deeds, and its hypnotic words to put up a smokescreen to divert the public from seeing the truth of its real threefold purpose. Pillaging the resources of less developed countries, money laundering, and population control, better known as the depopulation program. The money laundering will be clarified next. We promise you, when we're done with the UN and its NGOs, you will never donate another dollar ever again to any one of them. Let's continue with more crime, fraud, and the frontman of this entire scheme in Part 7.
Part 7 of the sequel of The Fall of the Cabal is what we just heard. And so I'm definitely going to move on to Part 8 here in a moment. We are now into the recording portion of the show, and we've got about, 39 minutes. So that leaves us with Part 8, which is 28 minutes. So I am going to play Part 8 of Sequel of Fall of the Cabal here next. And I'm actually going into a new tab so that I can on my own computer here. Oops. All right, Sequel to Follow Cabal, Part 7. I'm kind of queuing it up on my end, too, here for the video in addition to the audio. Just one second, and I'll kick it off. Okay. I got it queued up. All right. And get myself here. Okay. Here we go. Sequel to The Fall of the Cabal, Part 7. And kicking it off. 3, 2, 1, launch.
The United Nations, thought of by millions of people to be a benign organization with only our best interests at heart, turns out to be one of the main engines of the cabal. It is where deals are made, where money is laundered, and where dictators are kept steadily in their seats. The UN works with a multitude of NGOs, some officially under the umbrella of the UN, others more covertly. The term NGO, non-governmental organization, was actually invented by the UN back in 1945. You will soon understand why. It encompasses charities and non-profits, but also lobby groups for big corporations such as the World Economic Forum. At this moment, 5,500 NGOs have consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council. This means they have a formal relationship with the UN and are allowed to participate in the work of the UN. They are all independent from government control and answer to one entity only, the United Nations. Interesting fact in and of itself, don't you think? What we stumbled upon during our research was an enormous cash flow between these NGOs. It seems like they all support each other's work, like one big happy family. Well, that is mostly a sign of money laundering. Mind you, there are big names involved here. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Buffett Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Clinton Foundation. Big names moving around even bigger amounts of money. Their financial reports seem impeccable, of course, but the money flow gets lost in the abundance of NGOs involved, the non-specific destination of the billions of dollars moved around like grants to recipients. What does that mean? And the existence of alliances of NGOs that makes things even less transparent. Like, for instance, the Fund for Shared Insight, a group of seven funders, and a pool of financial and other resources to make grants to improve philanthropy. Nice and vague. Let's have a look at the Rockefeller Foundation. Did you know there's also the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Richard Rockefeller Fellowship, the David Rockefeller Fund, the Rockefeller Family Fund, the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, and the Eileen Rockefeller Growald Family Fund? They all move around tidal waves of money, I'm talking billions, often between foundations set up by members of the same family. Not only the Rockefellers show us clearly how to keep it in the family, Warren Buffett is another great example, with the Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, named after Warren's wife, the Sherwood Foundation, set up by their daughter Susan Alice, the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, with their son Howard as chairman and CEO, the Novo Foundation, co-funded by their son Peter and his wife Jennifer, and the Buffett Early Childhood Fund, set up by Warren's daughter again, Susan Alice. In July 2020, Warren Buffett announced that he would, once again, it's sort of an annual thing, be giving 15.9 million Class B shares of his mega company, Berkshire Hathaway, to five charities. Take a wild guess. All of these shares, worth $2.9 billion, went to the very same Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, the Sherwood Foundation, the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, the Novo Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Now, the latter is not a big surprise, as Warren Buffett had taken Bill Gates under his wings back in 1991, when his mother set up a meeting between her 37-year-old son and the excessively rich and powerful tycoon Warren Buffett. A deal was made, and from that moment on, the destinies of Bill and Warren were intertwined forever. More about which soon. Since 2006, Warren Buffett has moved $37 billion in shares to, well, basically his children, without paying a dime of tax. Why don't you try to donate some money to your children without the tax administration stepping in to claim a big chunk? By the way, the Buffett Foundation is known for its secrecy, often appearing under grand acknowledgements as an anonymous donor, which is rather strange when it concerns donations of many millions or even billions of dollars, simply unaccounted for. But like we said at the intro of this episode, these NGOs, no matter how big and powerful, are independent from government control. Let that sink in. The Buffett Foundation invests heavily in reproductive health and family planning grants across the world, including substantial investments in abortion and contraceptives. In the 1990s, the Buffett Foundation helped finance the development of the abortion drug RU486. Between 2001 and 2014, the foundation contributed over $1.5 billion to abortion-related causes, including at least $427 million to Planned Parenthood and $168 million to the National Abortion Federation. Remember from Part 6 that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave $89.5 million to Planned Parenthood? Were you shocked when you heard this number? Well, the Buffett Foundation makes the Gates Foundation pale in comparison. It gave Planned Parenthood $427 million. Why are all these most wealthy men alive so obsessed with killing babies? What we discovered upon investigating the largest and most influential NGOs was that they all primarily focus on reproductive health. In our previous episode, we showed you what that really means in practice. Eugenics, depopulation, pillaging less developed countries for their precious minerals, and money laundering. One of the brilliant moves when it comes to money laundering is the transfer to subsidiaries, also known as child companies, to make things even less transparent. Let's have a look at some examples. Ever heard of Arabella Advisors? Probably not. Yet, you should. Here's why. Arabella Advisors is a for-profit consulting company founded in 2005 by former Clinton administration appointee Eric Kessler. According to Arabella's own website, they provide strategic guidance for effective philanthropy. Effective philanthropy, huh? Let's see what that means. Arabella claims to have carried out more than 150 projects for clients that are worth more than $100 billion. Not exactly a small fish, right? What else? Arabella manages 4 non-profits, and this is where it gets interesting. The New Venture Fund, the 1630 Fund, the Hopewell Fund, and the Windward Fund. These 4 non-profits serve as accelerators for yet another range of non-profits that, according to several investigative sources, are fake organizations that are little more than a website and a sweet address. Now, we dove into Arabella and its 4 minions because we saw them appear time and again in the midst of the giants, such as the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, etc. As we'd never heard of them before, we decided to look into them. It took us many 24/7 weeks. Never before were financial reports so confusing, so non-transparent. Arabella Advisors and its 4 non-profits use tax regulations to the max, moving money from C3s to C4s, which is more profitable when it comes to tax deductions. Thanks to the pass-through arrangements, funding is passed from one organization to another, making it difficult to trace where a donor's money ends up. As we searched for weeks, our astonishment grew. Then we ran into the work of Capital Research Center. Our findings collaborated with those of their researchers, like Hayden Ludwig, who described Arabella as a dark money monster and the left's best-kept secret. Arabella is the left's best-kept secret that proves something money and politics reporters have failed to notice. Non-profits, not the parties, drive our politics. Since Arabella's inception, it's sponsored roughly 340 groups. These fake groups rarely disclose their relationship to Arabella Advisors or any of its 4 in-house non-profits. Nevertheless, many of them accept donations from the public, funds which go to Arabella's non-profits. This system also allows these groups to hide their funders, since it's virtually impossible to trace individual grants to Arabella's four non-profits to any particular faith group. These 340 pop-up groups are slick websites posing as grassroots activist groups that can appear and vanish in an instant. Since 2006, this network has pumped a stunning $2.4 billion into politics. Between 2008 and 2018, Arabella's four non-profits paid the company nearly $103 million in contracting and management services fees. Interesting money flow, but it gets more interesting. According to various independent researchers, Arabella and its four non-profits equal dark money. Dark money is money raised to influence elections. This money is raised by non-profit organizations that do not have to disclose the identity of their donors. In other words, a complete lack of transparency where it concerns millions and millions of dollars, all aimed at one goal and one goal alone, influencing the outcome of elections, or more concrete, making sure the Democrats win at all costs. Let's see if we can find any evidence for such a crude accusation, shall we? Let's have a look at Arabella's four non-profits. Any clues there to such conspiracy theories? First, there is the 1630 Fund. In 2018, it received massive anonymous donations. It later turned out that $26.7 million had come from the New Venture Fund, one of its sister funds. The 1630 Fund, the 501c4 advocacy wing of Arabella's non-profit network, is a massive dark money group that boosted Democrats in the 2018 midterm elections with $140 million. The 1630 Fund's biggest single donation, made anonymously, was for $51.7 million, more than the group had ever raised before in an entire year before President Donald Trump was elected. One of 1613 Fund's projects, or pop-up groups, is Demand Justice, an anti-Trump organization. At the beginning of 2018, Demand Justice did not exist, but given the fear that President Trump would nominate federal judges, Arabella popped it into existence with more than $2.5 million from George Soros' Open Society Foundations. It was the same organization that blasted Justice Brett Kavanaugh during his Supreme Court confirmation. Interesting. What about number two, the Hopewell Fund? The Hopewell Fund is a 501c3 non-profit created in 2015. It primarily manages pro-abortion projects, including Equity Forward, which attacks the Trump administration for opposing the left-wing abortion agenda. Okay. What about number three? The New Venture Fund. The New Venture Fund, located at the same address, the same suite, number 300, a platform for philanthropists. Between 2014 and 18, New Venture Fund received $1.6 billion in donations. In 2018 alone, this was $395 million, for which they hired consultants for a total sum of $28.3 million, of which $90 million went straight back to Arabella advisors is Mother Company. To give you a nice little example, New Venture Fund sponsors its own project, Media Democracy Fund, located at the same address in DC and the exact same suite, number 300. Media Democracy Fund describes itself as a catalyst for an open, secure, and equitable internet. God knows what that has to do with charity. Well, we can tell you why it was set up in the first place. To push Obama's net neutrality. In other words, to increase the government's control of the internet. We're talking censorship. Media Democracy Fund is run by a few young people with no surnames and no real profile pictures. Still, since its founding in 2006, it has made more than $34 million. Oh, and surprise, it is supported by the Open Society Foundations of George Soros, the multi-billionaire we showed in part two of The Fall of the Cabal, the man responsible for his destabilizing and dividing mega-projects, such as the illegal alien invasion, Black Lives Matter, and Antifa. Yet another interesting little detail about New Venture Fund is their interest in America Votes, yet another one of their fake bobs. New Venture Fund gave a $2.35 million grant to America Votes in 2018, which is a lot of money for a business that, according to its own website, aims to advance progressive policies and win elections. Win elections? Wow, I mean, that is weird. I thought we were looking at charity funds here, right? Well, obviously not. Oh, a New Venture Fund sister, the 1630 Fund, gave no less than $27 million to America Votes. All you have to do is take a look at who sponsors America Votes. Take a wild guess, my friends. Democratic Attorneys General Association, Democratic Governors Association, Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, Democrats.com, National Democratic Redistricting Committee, oh, and let's not forget Planned Parenthood and Stand Up America, committed to resisting Trump's agenda and unrigging the corrupt system that put him in the White House. Let's make something clear once and for all. First, the corrupt system is exactly what President Trump is fighting. It is the corrupt system that tried to prevent Donald J. Trump from entering the White House. Furthermore, whether you like Trump or not is not relevant. He is your president. He was elected twice by a majority of the American people. That is called democracy. Now, just because you hate Trump doesn't mean he was put in the White House by mistake. There was no Russian collusion, remember? Years of investigations have gone by in which the Democrats did everything they possibly could think of to get rid of their opponent. Well, guess what? It didn't work. They failed miserably. You want to know why? Because, and I will say this again loud and clear, because Donald J. Trump was elected by the majority of the American people to be their president. That's why. So my question to the Democratic Trump haters out there is, which part of democracy don't you understand? The amount of money that is moved around within the limits of the law is staggering. The more we studied this topic, the more we realized that in order to drain the swamp in philanthropy land, laws would have to be rewritten. Over the past 5 years, the David and Lucille Packard Foundation donated no less than $245 million to NGOs working in the area of reproductive health. Remember these names, they will return again and again. Once you understand who they are and how they play the world stage, moving assets around, dominating national policies, you will never again think of these titans as philanthropists. Take Pathfinder. The Pathfinder Fund, fully into reproductive health and family planning, we now know what that means, was founded in 1957 by Clarence Gamble, heir to the Procter & Gamble fortune, an advocate of birth control, forced sterilization of mental patients, and eugenics. Pathfinder received $673 million over the past 5 years to be used for their reproductive health projects. Where did this money come from? Well, their main donors and grantors are the Gates Foundation, the Buffett Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Vanguard, Fidelity, Swap, Tides, Global Health Initiatives, part of the WHO, and USAID, that awarded $970 million to Pathfinder in the form of grants and contracts between 2005 and 2021. Other donors are the Novo Foundation, Open Society Foundations from George Soros, the Passport Foundation, Robertson Foundation, Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Rockefeller Foundation, and Wellspring Philanthropic Fund. We cannot stress sufficiently to please do your own research. Simply take one of these sheets and dive into these names. Take Fidelity. According to its IRS Form 990 for 2018, Fidelity Investments Charitable Gift Fund moved nearly $107 million to two of Arabella's nonprofits. The New Venture Fund, $73 million. And Hopewell Fund, $34 million. We can, however, assure you that you will get stuck in the spiderweb of C3s and C4s, and that's where you will meet the end of transparency, if it ever was there in the first place. You see, even though you get some information through the IRS Form 990, the umbrella company, Arabella, is a for-profit organization, which means they do not have to fill in a 990 form. That's where darkness sets in. As in, indeed, dark money. Okay, let's have a look at the Rockefeller Foundation. I showed the massive power empire of the Rockefellers in my first documentary about the fall of the cabal, in part two. Now please bear in mind that the Rockefeller Foundation 990 forms contain between 350 and 400 pages each year. So what we did, after having studied each and every one of them, we narrowed it down for you by highlighting some anomalies, those donations that jumped out for their numbers and or recipients. The Rockefeller Foundation gave $666,666 to the City University of New York. Interesting number, associated with the number of the beast. Okay, I'm sure that's just a coincidence, right? The Rockefeller Foundation gave $4 million to DataKind, an NGO for data science. Funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Open Society Foundations, Microsoft, Rockefeller Foundation, Hewlett Foundation, MasterCard, Google, and others. A data science company? then it gave $25.7 million to the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. More about this scandalous fraud in Part 9. In 2018 alone, the Rockefeller Foundation invested no less than $4.1 billion. Most of the money went to investment companies such as BlackRock, with $4.4 billion in securities apart from charitable purposes. To cut a long and boring story short, let's put it this way. After God knows how many hours of research into the financial reports of these NGOs, we came to the following conclusions. All charity NGOs in which millions of dollars are moved around have nothing to do with charity whatsoever. They are simply the perfect business model for money laundering. In spite of the millions or even billions of dollars involved, no tax is paid. The astronomical amounts of money are, apart from being laundered, transferred to support the Democrats and their agendas. Think abortion facilities and other family planning and population control topics. As such, it is the non-profits that drive US policies, not the political parties. Most charity money goes directly to Wall Street, to NASDAQ and other stock exchanges, where it is invested in, well, anything lucrative. Those are projects you do not get access to unless you have a certain clearance level. It could range from legal to illegal investments such as drug and human trafficking. Arabella helps its clients implement center-left political agendas through sometimes risky programming investments. So, our question to you is this. How do you feel about your donation to charity being used to avoid tax, to be invested in risky programming investments, which could be anything, and to go straight to the Democrat Party, either to support a presidential election or to rig one, or to help fund one of their projects such as population control or any other means or method to facilitate the new world order? How does that make you feel? How can it be that these so-called charities don't have to account for so much money, both where it came from and where it went to? How can it be that these NGOs that move billions around work from a simple suite? There are countless consultancies involved in charity that are granted millions of dollars to do their work. Why, for heaven's sake? I mean, suppose you advise individuals and companies on how to invest money into charity. Don't you simply get paid for your services by your clients? Why does an office for data science receive millions and millions of dollars? To do what? And why is it a non-profit organization? Why does it have major sponsors such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Open Society Foundation, Microsoft, Rockefeller Foundation, Hewlett Foundation, MasterCard, Google? Why do these NGOs form alliances in order to improve philanthropy? How hard is it to pick a fund and donate? The more we dove into the subject, the more we realized just how insane this all was. Within the limits of the law, oh yes, but insane and wrong nevertheless. The UN, with all of its NGOs and charity funds, connected either directly or indirectly, moving billions around, hens and forth, laundering money to their heart's content, investing enormous amounts on the stock market, making more money and more and even more without ever having to pay a dime of tax. And like I said, they are all independent from government control and answer to one entity alone, the United Nations. Does this mean all NGOs are bad news? Probably not. I'm sure the smaller ones and the local ones have not been dragged into the dark swamp. I'm sure they do great work, real charity. But the big ones, the ones with the multi-million dollar sign on them, like Oxfam, that held sex orgies with minors in Haiti? Minors as in children? Like the Red Cross, that after a history of discrimination of black and gay people, whom they refused to help during times of despair, collected $500 million for Haiti in 2010 after the devastating earthquake, and used that money to build 6 houses? When you find out how much the presidents of those NGOs make, will you donate money ever again? So, where does all of the above leave us? In a big, sticky, criminal spider web with hungry spiders everywhere. One of those spiders is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Follow me to part 8.
All right, so that wraps up part 7 of sequel of Fall of the Cabal. And I think, just in the nick of time, because we got 3 minutes left for the recording of the show. And so with that, I guess we will continue this on. I might just set up an episode for tomorrow night, the same time, 6 to 9 p.m., same deal, and continue on, because this is a good stopping point, actually. I'm glad the timing worked out the way it did, because this is where they'll start to really get into the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Bill Gates and stuff, and more of these so-called philanthropists, and so it's going to be pretty cool. So, I will set up a new show for tomorrow night, because even I want to continue this on. Anybody that's been listening, I'm sure that you're probably going to want to listen. So, again, that is the sequel of The Fall of the Cabal. You can find it on BitChute. Look up Fall Cabal, F-A-L-L-C-A-B-A-L, Fall Cabal, all one word. Subscribe to them. And you can scroll through their list and you can watch the videos, which I encourage you to do so, because they present a lot of visuals along with the audio, right? So definitely do that, and I will set up another show, so keep an eye out. We'll do this again tomorrow night, and we will continue on with the next part of the series, and which will be part 8. And it's a pretty intriguing series. And then you guys can kind of sleep on everything that you just heard. Then we'll continue with part 8, which is the Gates Foundation vaccination scandals. So it'll be interesting. And Daniel, I see you've been hanging on, so I'm gonna unmute you. Hello, are you there? Hello? Uh-oh, it ended. Ah, crap. How did it end?